You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 133, Long Live America. Thanks for joining me. As always, before we get started, I'd like to thank those of you who are signed up on Patreon. Your support keeps the show going. We are in something of a golden age for independent media, not only podcasts, but through Substack, YouTube, and other similar outlets. It's never been easier for people like me to get our work out there without having to rely on the traditional intermediaries. Maybe the day will come when someone figures out how to make this internet-based independent creator model viable through advertising alone, but I don't see it happening anytime soon. The simple truth is, the overwhelming majority of these projects would evaporate without direct financial support from the audience. We're all relying on you to vote with your wallets. If there's some independent media out there you believe deserves to be heard or read or seen, I would encourage you to do your part by supporting it however you can. Not only this show, but anything that's made with care and effort, without some kind of institutional support behind it. This is the only way people like me are able to do what we do. Anyway, last episode we examined Spanish America on the eve of the Wars of Independence. We closed out with the catalyst that would set off over a decade of warfare and political chaos, the news of the abdications of Bayonne. Napoleon had shocked the world by forcing the Spanish Bourbon dynasty off their throne and installing his brother Joseph in their place. Support for the monarchy was nearly universal in Spanish America, at least on the surface. The only people who dared to utter the word republic were a tiny handful of intellectuals, influenced by the French and American revolutions, and most of them only ever did so in private, knowing the vast majority of their countrymen felt differently and that the authorities were not forgiving to dissenters. But what did loyalty to the monarchy mean now, in light of this earth-shattering news from Europe? Napoleon hoped the colonists would accept Joseph Bonaparte as their new king. If you'll think back to our episodes on the beginning of the French invasion, he had bullied much of the Spanish aristocracy into swearing an oath of loyalty to Joseph. Maybe their counterparts in the New World would follow suit. As we've discussed in past episodes, the loss of Haiti and a subsequent sale of Louisiana represented the end of Napoleon's grand ambitions of colonial expansion. But that is only obvious in hindsight. The French were always looking for opportunities to recapture those dreams of global empire, and many within the halls of power in Paris saw Spanish America as the perfect starting point. This was not the primary reason behind Napoleon's decision to invade Spain, but it was certainly a secondary concern. After Joseph took the throne in Madrid, Napoleon sent representatives to the colonial capitals to obtain promises of loyalty from the administrators. They got a frosty reception, to put it mildly. One of these envoys would later recall the locals were so hostile he actually feared he would be assaulted. Another had to be put into protective custody after the colonial authorities learned of a plot to assassinate him. Across the entirety of Spanish America, among all the various classes of people we discussed last episode, there was practically zero support for King José Bonaparte and the French. Even among the small minority of intellectuals who had come under the influence of French Enlightenment ideas, there was nobody of any consequence who was eager to be ruled from Paris. Unfortunately, it seems that was about all the people of Spanish America could agree on. The news from Europe shook Spanish colonial societies to their very foundations. The legitimacy of all civil authority was suddenly called into question. Spanish America was mostly a top-down enterprise, with the royal governors at the top of the chain of command. As we discussed last episode, the governors drew their authority from their status as hand-picked representatives of the king, empowered to speak and act in his name. But, as we just discussed, essentially everyone agreed the king in Madrid was an illegitimate usurper. Just like in Spain, there was consensus that King Ferdinand's abdication was coerced, and therefore illegitimate, making Ferdinand the rightful sovereign of Spain, and therefore the colonies as well. However, Ferdinand was now a prisoner of Napoleon, so, in effect, the throne was vacant. In Spain itself, the elite had responded by forming juntas, committees of prominent citizens, civil servants, military and church leaders, and politicians, that would rule on a provisional basis until some legitimate authority could be established. This had not been a smooth or easy process, but as we saw in past episodes, the people of Spain did more or less rally behind the juntas and accepted their legitimacy, at least on a temporary basis. The situation in Spanish America was quite different. In the weeks and months after the news of Ferdinand's abdication arrived on the continent, people came to very different ideas about what should be done in response. Two schools of thought began to coalesce. The first held that the status quo had lost all legitimacy. Authority flowed down from the governors by virtue of their status as representatives of the king. But the throne was now vacant, making the governors effectively representatives of nobody at all, which is maybe an interesting logic puzzle, but not the basis for a stable, lawful government. According to this school of thought, without a legitimate king on the throne in Madrid, the colonial authorities had lost their legitimacy too. Thus, it fell to the people of Spanish America to form juntas to govern their own countries themselves, just as their cousins in Spain were doing. As you might imagine, this point of view was most common among those born and raised in the colonies, many of whom had never been very happy with their Spanish colonial administrators to begin with, and some of whom privately harbored pro-independence sentiments. At this point in our story, these factions were not well defined enough to have names, but this group is known to history as the Patriots. At this early stage, the Patriots were practically unanimous in declaring their loyalty to the imprisoned King Ferdinand. Historians debate just how sincere they were. Some probably were envisioning a future in which Ferdinand remained their king, but all other political ties to Spain would be severed. For others, these declarations of loyalty were purely strategic, a way to appear respectable, while hiding their more radical goals of republican government and true independence. Historians have dubbed this strategy the Mask of Ferdinand. The other school of thought maintained that very little should change. With the colonies falling into political uncertainty, surely this was the time to rally around the existing authorities, not to indulge in radical political experiments. After all, the governors were not the representatives of the king in some direct personal sense. They represented the Spanish crown as an institution. They were officials of the executive branch of government, not personal chums of the king. Thus, they believed, the colonial administrations were still the legitimate representatives of the Spanish government, and should be obeyed just as they had been before the news arrived. As you might imagine, this point of view was most common among the peninsulares, people who had been born in Spain, many of whom saw their dominion over the colonies as a birthright. They would be joined by Creoles with close ties to the mother country, and people who opposed the Patriots for political or ideological reasons, or out of personal loyalty to their governors. As of yet, this faction had no name, but in time they would come to be known as the Royalists. This nascent conflict between Patriots and Royalists was not just some arcane legal debate about constitutional theory. Remember, the Spanish Empire was at war, and the war was not just some distant, irrelevant thing. Before Spain was forced to switch sides, the British had tried to conquer the Rio de la Plata twice, and the Royal Navy blockade had done terrible damage to the economies of Spanish America. The Caribbean, just north of New Granada and just east of New Spain, was a war zone. There had also been Francisco de Miranda's abortive invasion of Coro, which was perceived by many as a foreign invasion, although Miranda himself would certainly have disputed that. After the sale of Louisiana, New Spain now shared a border with the young United States. Many U.S. leaders harbored ambitions of conquering Spanish territory in the New World, which was well known among the Spanish colonials. As we just discussed, Napoleon had his own ambitions for the region as well, and after the arrival of his representatives, those ambitions were no secret. Not only were the colonial elite under pressure from hostile foreign powers, they were afraid of their own subjects, too. The example of Haiti was certainly fresh in everyone's minds. Everywhere from Baltimore to Buenos Aires, in every slaveholding society in the New World, white people were sleeping a little less easily, and looking at the enslaved people in their midst in a different light. In Spanish America, there were also relatively recent memories of a violent indigenous uprising that had taken place in the 1780s in the Viceroyalty of Peru. A man born into the aristocracy of the old Inca Empire had declared himself Sapa Inca, or Emperor, taking on the regnal name Tupac Amaru II, after the last Sapa Inca, who had been deposed by the Spanish hundreds of years earlier. Tupac Amaru II raised an impressive army, perhaps as many as 100,000 strong, and was able to seriously threaten Spanish authority over Peru. Tupac Amaru himself was captured by the Spanish within a few months and brutally executed, but his followers continued fighting for years. Even by the standards of 18th century colonial warfare, the Tupac Amaru rebellion and subsequent crackdown were incredibly violent. After the war was over, the Spanish had inflicted terrible reprisals on local indigenous groups. Even after 25 years, these are not the types of things people forget. Those who were not old enough to actually remember the rebellion had all grown up in its shadow. The colonial elite were even scared of certain elements of the white and mixed-race population. As I mentioned last episode, there were no real independence movements to speak of, but that didn't mean there was not unrest, and that unrest sometimes boiled over. Civil disturbances, riots, and even minor revolts over local issues like taxes or trade restrictions were not uncommon. Just like their counterparts in Europe, the ruling classes of Spanish America all feared what they referred to as the mob. Faced with these threats, or at least perceived threats, from both within and without, the ruling classes of Spanish America engaged in this emerging conflict between patriots and royalists with great urgency. The news from Spain bred uncertainty, and under these conditions, uncertainty bred fear. People on both sides felt it was a matter of life or death, that their societies were on the brink of catastrophe, and only their preferred solution stood any chance of salvaging things. Many on both sides were in no mood to tolerate dissent. They felt drastic action had to be taken to save their countries. That meant anyone who stood in the way of that drastic action was a mortal enemy. For those already in power, that meant ruthlessly crushing those on the other side. For those without power, that meant seizing it by any means necessary. Many on both sides felt they were simply doing what they had to do to defend their homes, uphold the law, and maintain order. But their drastically different visions of how to do this put them in direct opposition, and often made them view the other side as traitors. This nascent conflict between royalists and patriots was by far the most important political fault line opening up during this period of uncertainty. But it was not the only one. Class and racial divisions were becoming more acute as well. There were also regional conflicts. With only 4 colonial governors across the entire Spanish Main, there were a lot of places far from their colonial capital that enjoyed some degree of autonomy, or felt that their local interests diverged from those of the colony at large. Many people had begun to question the idea of direct rule from Spain, but some of them didn't want to be ruled by their local colonial capital either. The militias would play a key role in the coming struggle. The vast majority of quote-unquote Spanish forces in the mainland Americas were not regulars from the mother country, but part-time militias recruited from among the colonists. As we saw last episode, in some parts of Spanish America, there were no regulars at all. The military defense and most aspects of what we would call policing were handled by the militias. There were some peninsulares active in their local units, but by and large, the militias were dominated by the Americanos. The Catholic Church would be an important player as well, although perhaps we should not be referring to the Church in Spanish America in the singular. The leadership would be almost lockstep behind the royalist cause, because, as we discussed last episode, they were almost all peninsulares. Among the faithful, and even among the rank-and-file clergy, there was much more diversity of belief and opinion, and even practice. As we'll see later in the episode, there were even Roman Catholic priests who supported the ideals of the Enlightenment and French Revolution, the Pope's intellectual and political arch-enemies. With all that background, perhaps it's not surprising that in the years after the abdications of Bayonne, violence and civil unrest would touch almost every corner of Spanish America. For the remainder of this episode, we'll go colony by colony and see how the state of fear and uncertainty devolved into armed conflict. I'm writing this episode on the territory of the Viceroyalty of New Spain, so we might as well start there. New Spain was in a somewhat unusual position, because when news arrived of the abdications of Bayonne, the governor was already facing political problems. His name was José de Iturrigaray, and he was in hot water because he owed his position almost entirely to one man, his friend and political patron, Manuel Godoy. When he had the most powerful man in the country backing him, Iturrigaray could afford to rule however he wanted. He made enemies of powerful peninsulares and engaged in truly grotesque levels of personal corruption. After all, what was anyone going to do about it? The sudden loss of his political patron put the governor into a political tailspin. He began courting the local Creoles, desperate to shore up his regime by any means necessary. He was actually somewhat successful. Whatever his faults, it seems the governor did have a kind of personal charisma. The city council of the colonial capital, Mexico City, had a large number of Creole members, and definitely leaned towards the patriot viewpoint. They formally asked the governor to assume provisional authority over the colony and to form juntas of local notables to help him rule. Effectively, this would mean sidelining the old colonial authorities and forming a new government that would be practically independent in almost every way, although everyone involved still loudly proclaimed their loyalty to the imprisoned King Ferdinand. It was a bold proposal, but the city council was relatively powerless. Otherwise, the peninsulares would not have allowed so many Americano upstarts to get involved. The real authorities shut down this proposal, but the conservative royalist establishment was shocked by this affair. The governor had seemed amenable to this idea, which they saw as tantamount to treason. They already hated Iturrigaray for his corruption and overindulgent attitude to the locals. This was the last straw. The governor had to go. In the wee hours of September 15, 1808, a large group of armed men stormed the governor's residence. These were not the militia, but armed civilians, organized by conservative local businessmen. Iturrigaray seems not to have been expecting trouble. The house was barely guarded. After a very brief fight, the governor was arrested. He was formally charged with heresy and corruption, not with any explicitly political offense. But it was obvious to everyone his real crime was being seen as too close to the patriots. The coup plotters replaced Iturrigaray with the senior military officer in the colony, a peninsulare named Pedro de Garibay. Garibay had once been a very formidable figure, but in late 1808 he was 80 years old, and his health was so bad he could not physically sign his own name to official documents. The degree to which he was actually in charge is debatable, but the period of his administration saw a harsh crackdown on suspected patriots. The leading patriot intellectual in the colony, a Catholic friar named Melchor de Talamantes, was imprisoned in brutal conditions and soon died of disease, becoming the first martyr of the patriot cause. He would be far from the last. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Governor Garibay did not last long. He was soon replaced with Francisco Javier de Lizana y Beaumont, Archbishop of Mexico City. This was a smart move. In a deeply Catholic country being torn apart by politics, who better to stand as a figure of consensus than the local leader of the church? But the royalists would come to regret this choice. In late 1809, colonial authorities uncovered a patriot conspiracy in the city of Valladolid. A group of mostly Creole militia officers and priests were planning to raise an army of indigenous peasants by promising them an end to the hated system of indigenous tribute. Then they would use this force to chase the royalists out of Mexico City and form a new government based around local juntas. They were arrested and put on trial. Their lawyer warned, quote, "The day the first insurgent is hanged, Spain must abandon any hope of holding on to America," end quote. The conspirators were brought before the governor, Archbishop Lizana. They explained they were just loyal subjects of King Ferdinand, doing what they felt was necessary to save the country. Amazingly, Lizana was convinced they were sincere, and probably worried about the backlash if such men were convicted of treason. He ordered them released. The archbishop's royalist supporters were outraged and began pulling strings to have him replaced. Soon, yet another new governor was on his way. It was actually someone we have met before, General Francisco Javier Venegas, who had been so badly beaten by Marshal Victor at the Battle of Uclés in early 1809. Unlike his predecessors, Venegas was a man of action and a dyed-in-the-wool supporter of absolute monarchy. However, he would have his work cut out for him. By the time the new governor arrived in his capital, events were already in motion that would drag the country into open war. In the autumn of 1810, there was another patriot conspiracy afoot, this one based in the city of Querétaro and surrounding area. This was part of a rich and densely populated region known as the Bajío, just north of the capital. The conspirators were the type of people you might expect: militia officers, Creole local government officials, and a few Catholic clergymen with liberal sympathies. The most notable of their number was the parish priest of the nearby village of Dolores, 57-year-old Father Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla. Father Hidalgo is an amazing character. I wish we had time to delve more deeply into his biography. To make a very long story short, early in his life he'd had a promising career as a professor. But he had never been a perfect fit for academia. Hidalgo was highly intelligent, erudite, and could argue and debate with the best of them. But he was also a bit of a contrarian. His personal beliefs were very liberal, even radical, and he enjoyed what we might call a bohemian lifestyle. All of these things are pretty typical for a modern professor, but Hidalgo's college was not only an institution of higher learning, it was a Catholic religious establishment. Many found Hidalgo's behavior scandalous, and it seems Hidalgo eventually got tired of being constantly forced to justify himself. So he took the appointment to become a parish priest in Dolores. On paper, this was a much less prestigious position, for which Hidalgo was massively overqualified. However, he was now much freer to pursue his calling as he saw fit. He learned the languages of the local indigenous groups, and worked to economically develop the countryside around Dolores and improve the lives of the local peasants. Soon, he came to be seen as something of an unofficial local leader. He was liked and trusted by the people, and well known to have liberal sympathies, which is why the Patriot conspirators sought him out and recruited him into their plot. On the appointed day, Hidalgo and his co-conspirators would rally the people and call out sympathetic militia units. Then they would all march on Mexico City to force a change of government. Father Hidalgo was not the originator of the conspiracy, but through his intelligence, charisma, and reputation among the locals, he quickly rose to a position of leadership. In September of 1810, the conspiracy was betrayed. It had gotten too big. Too many people knew the secret. Inevitably, someone at the bottom of the chain of command got spooked, had second thoughts, and reported everything they knew to their local authorities. However, in an amazing stroke of luck for the Patriots, the colonial authority who received this confession was himself a member of the conspiracy. He had no choice but to inform his superiors and launch an investigation to keep up appearances. But he also delayed and undermined this investigation at every opportunity, while his wife sent word to the other members of the conspiracy, warning them of the danger. The timing was terrible. The launch date for the rebellion was only about 2 weeks away. A lot of the preparations were already made, and a lot of people were committed. Once loyal colonial officials started investigating in earnest, they would find evidence everywhere. Someone had to decide what to do. Would the conspirators flee, do nothing and hope the government bungled the investigation, or launch the rebellion early without all the proper groundwork? Father Hidalgo resolved to fight. Early on the morning of September 16, 1810, the priest gathered everyone he could find outside the Church of Our Lady of Sorrows in Dolores to deliver the most important speech in Mexican history. Amazingly, no one knows what was said. This would be almost like if the text of the American Declaration of Independence or the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen had been lost to history. But it was a chaotic situation. Hidalgo was improvising. If he ever wrote the speech down, the document was lost in the chaotic events that followed. This much is clear. The speech was a call to arms. Hidalgo denounced to the colonial government. He told the people they would have to fight to protect their rights and save their country from foreign domination. He also invoked the Virgin of Guadalupe, patron saint of the Americas, who would become the symbol of this movement. By all accounts, it was an impassioned and rousing speech. Consensus seems to be that it included a series of declarations or slogans, probably at the end. One version reads, quote, "Long live the Catholic religion, long live Ferdinand VII, long live the fatherland, and may our sacred patroness, the Most Holy Virgin of Guadalupe, reign forever in this American continent. Death to bad government." End quote. Another version reads, quote, "Long live America, long live Ferdinand VII, long live religion, and death to the Spaniards." End quote. And yet another, quote, "Long live our Most Holy Mother of Guadalupe, long live Ferdinand VII, and death to bad government." End quote. Hidalgo's speech has gone down in history as the Cry of Dolores. Today, the anniversary is commemorated in Mexico as the country's Independence Day, and a modernized version of that fragment I just read to you is delivered by the President of Mexico. The exact wording will probably never be known, but the gist is clear. Hidalgo was calling for resistance to the colonial government and invoking a kind of proto-Mexican patriotism. Whatever exactly was said, it seems to have made quite an impression on those who heard it. The conspirators rallied their forces, and as word of the rebellion spread, people began converging on Dolores to join. Soon, there were nearly 1,000 rebels assembled. They began marching around the Bajío, collecting recruits and gaining strength. Father Hidalgo took a painting of Our Lady of Guadalupe and fashioned it into a banner, which he personally carried with him as he led the column. They must have made quite a sight as they journeyed through central Mexico. All walks of life could be seen within the rebel ranks, Everyone from unarmed indigenous peasants carrying pictures of the Virgin of Guadalupe to Creole militia officers in full uniform carrying modern weapons. Part religious pilgrimage, part military expedition. Father Hidalgo continued wearing his simple black clergyman's cassock, now accented with a general's sash and a pair of pistols tucked into the belt. He gave himself a grand title, Generalissimo of America. And why not? By this point, the small patriot conspiracy had blossomed into an army capable of threatening the colonial order. It had started in a very unlikely place, but the colony of New Spain had begun to feel the first birth pangs of a united Mexican nation. We've focused on New Spain so far, but there were similar dynamics at play all over Spanish America, shaped by local conditions and the personalities involved. Depending on your perspective, the Viceroyalty of Peru was either lucky or unlucky to be ruled by a very competent and energetic royal governor, a former military officer named José Fernando de Abascal y Sousa. When news of the abdications of Bayonne reached Peru, Governor Abascal had only been in office about 2 years, but had already distinguished himself as a capable leader. He threw himself immediately into ambitious programs of public works, economic development, and even improved healthcare. Unlike many colonial officials, Abascal seems to have embraced the mission of building up the colony and providing for the welfare of its people, rather than seeing Peru simply as a cash cow for the mother country. Unfortunately for the patriots, he was also a very staunch royalist and a true believer in the ideal of absolute monarchy. He saw the suppression of the patriots as a sacred charge, and would pursue that goal with the same energy and intelligence he did all his other duties. Abascal could be very generous when the situation called for it, but people were about to learn that he was also capable of great ruthlessness. Ironically, despite Abascal's energy and competence, he was the first Spanish governor to be directly challenged by the patriots. In August of 1809, prominent citizens of the city of Quito in the far north of the colony formed a junta. Like almost all patriots of this period, they proclaimed their loyalty to King Ferdinand, but rejected the authority of the entire colonial administration. This was very early, over a year before Father Hidalgo made his famous cry of Dolores. But Quito had a long history of protest and resistance, so perhaps this was a fitting place for the first blow to be struck. Today, August 10th, the anniversary of the foundation of the junta, is celebrated as Ecuadorian Independence Day. The junta of Quito called for aid from other nearby cities, but all its neighbors were cowed by news from the colonial capital. Governor Abascal was marshaling his forces to crush the junta. Quito had to stand alone, and soon the city was surrounded by royalist forces. The junta's small, improvised army was no match for the governor. It was all over pretty quickly. By the end of October, Quito was back under colonial rule. Members of the junta and other prominent patriots were arrested and imprisoned. They were charged with insulting the monarchy, a crime akin to treason, carrying a potential sentence of death. Apparently, the prosecutor didn't buy their claims to have seized power in the name of King Ferdinand. Despite this huge setback, the remaining Quito patriots were not deterred. They began plotting to liberate their imprisoned comrades before they could be convicted, which was obviously inevitable. The plan went into effect on August 2, 1810, almost exactly a year after they had formed their doomed junta. Patriot sympathizers began ringing church bells across the city to call out the people. Then they led the crowds to the prison and barracks, hoping to overwhelm the authorities with sheer force of numbers. The plan seemed to be working. The city garrison was paralyzed, and members of the crowd began to storm the prison. Then someone made a fateful decision. Sources differ as to who gave the order, but a Spanish military officer or colonial official inside the prison told the guards to massacre all the patriots inside before they could be freed. The order was carried out indiscriminately. A local lawyer named Manuel Quiroga, who had been the junta's minister of justice, was being visited by his two young daughters when the trouble broke out. They were cut down alongside everyone else, even though they hadn't even been accused of a crime. Once the killing started inside the prison, it soon spilled out into the streets. Royalist troops slaughtered hundreds of civilians, almost all of whom were unarmed, and some of whom had not even been involved in the protest. Once the crowds dispersed, the soldiers began to loot. They were supposed to be Quito's garrison, protecting the city, but they were treating it like conquered foreign land. News of this atrocity in Quito shocked all of Spanish America. People on both sides of the political divide were coming to understand that this would be a war to the death. Meanwhile, at almost the same time, in the far south of the colony, patriots in the city of Santiago in modern Chile formed their own junta. The local colonial authorities in the city had just been implicated in a huge corruption scandal. Many local people disliked being governed from faraway Lima in the first place. This scandal was the last straw. The junta ousted the local authorities and declared the southern region of the viceroyalty independent. Importantly, they did not declare independence from the monarchy. They, too, were careful to declare their loyalty to the imprisoned King Ferdinand. But they wanted no more of the colonial administration and desired to govern themselves. Calling themselves the Provisional Governing Junta of the Kingdom in the name of Ferdinand VII, the patriots began organizing national institutions, including a military. They designed a tricolor flag, very similar to the ones used by liberal movements in Europe. They even began organizing elections. Governor Abascal was unable to respond immediately. Events were now in motion that would eventually lead to the independence of this whole southern region of the viceroyalty. Today, the date of the formation of the Santiago Junta, September 18th, is commemorated as Chilean Independence Day. To the northeast was the region commonly known as Upper Peru, roughly corresponding to the modern country of Bolivia. We discussed this area last episode. It had formerly been a part of the Viceroyalty of Peru, but had been reassigned to the new Viceroyalty of the Rio de la Plata during Spain's recent reorganization of its colonial empire. Upper Peru was far from both Lima and Buenos Aires. Its local officials had a lot of autonomy, and it had its own regional identity, distinct from both its former overlords in Peru and its new overlords in the Rio de la Plata. Given this local distinctiveness and history of autonomy, perhaps it's no surprise that the cities of Upper Peru saw some of the first declarations of juntas by local patriots. In April of 1809, rumors began to spread in the city of Chuquisaca, today known as Sucre, alleging that the local colonial authorities were plotting to turn the whole region over to the Portuguese. With patriot ideas already swirling around the colony, this proved to be the spark that lit a bonfire. The people of the city rose up in a spontaneous rebellion, ousting the Peninsulare colonial officials. However, they stopped short of organizing a junta, leaving their local government intact. This so-called Chuquisaca Revolution emboldened the patriots in the region. The nearby city of La Paz followed suit a few months later, and its revolution was much more radical. The La Paz patriots organized a junta, and not only that, they formally declared independence, both from the viceroyalty and from Spain. As we've discussed, this region had been transferred to the colony of the Rio de la Plata, so technically speaking, the responsibility for addressing these developments fell to the authorities in Buenos Aires. But it was Governor Abascal of Peru who moved first. He sent soldiers to Upper Peru with orders to end the juntas and crush the patriots by any means necessary. By the time the troops arrived, the juntas had only barely begun to assert their authority. They did not stand a chance. Hundreds of patriots were arrested or killed, and Upper Peru once again fell under the authority of the Viceroyalty of Peru. The revolution had been extinguished almost as quickly as it erupted. But the people in this part of Spanish America had gotten a taste of real independence. It had been brief and ended in tragedy, but it had only whetted their appetites for more. Meanwhile, their nominal overlords in Buenos Aires were facing their own problems. As we discussed last episode, the defeat of the British invasions of the colony had given the local people a new confidence and a sense of their own strength, especially within the capital of Buenos Aires. Patriot sentiment was strong and growing. Our old friend, Governor Santiago Linier, had been replaced. The authorities back in Spain considered Linier untrustworthy, suspecting he had Bonapartist sympathies. As far as I can tell, this was nothing but prejudice towards Linier's French origins. He had been a loyal servant of the King of Spain his entire adult life. They dispatched a naval officer named Baltasar de Cisneros to replace Linier as governor. Linier was popular and perhaps could have resisted this act of ingratitude if he'd wanted to, but instead he decided to retire and moved to a farm in the interior of the colony. Cisneros assumed the office of governor in the summer of 1809. Like every other Spanish colonial official, Governor Cisneros was facing growing unrest among the population. The local patriot movement grew stronger by the day. In their secret meetings, the Rioplatense patriots began to talk of an uprising, but their leaders preferred to bide their time, continuing to build their strength and allow the political situation to develop until they saw an opening to take on the governor. In early 1810, important news began to filter into the colony from Spain. We'll discuss this in detail in a future episode, but to make a long story short, the Spanish and their allies had suffered major defeats on the battlefield. The provisional government was in chaos, and some speculated the war in Iberia might soon end in a French victory. This was the moment the Rioplatense patriot leaders had been waiting for. They demanded the governor call an open cabildo in Buenos Aires. There is no real equivalent to an open cabildo in the Anglo-American political tradition. It was something between a city council meeting and an open public forum. Calling an open cabildo would be a dangerous move for the governor. It would almost certainly mean caving to some of the political demands of the local creoles. It could lead to the formation of a junta and full self-government, which the governor and his supporters did not want. However, the patriots had never been stronger, and Governor Cisneros had never been weaker. He was not in a position to refuse. On May 18, 1810, Cisneros caved, announcing that an open cabildo would be held in the city imminently, and that local patriot leaders would be included in its deliberations. What has gone down in history as the May Revolution had begun. It would prove to be a strange hybrid of illegal and legal activity. The focus of the revolution was the cabildo, which was perfectly legal and a well-established part of Spanish political tradition. However, throughout the proceedings, there would be armed mobs outside the cabildo building, stirred up by radical patriot agitators, and clearly just waiting for the patriot representatives inside the cabildo to give the signal to storm the building. The patriots knew they had the support of the mob. Many of their leaders were also officers in the militia. As they negotiated with the governor and the colonial establishment, they knew they could rely on the threat of force, direct or implied, to get their way. The cabildo was in session for days, sometimes extending its meetings well into the night. These were incredibly difficult negotiations. There was a lot at stake and not much room for compromise. And all the while, there was that menacing crowd right outside. Everyone involved was keenly aware that if the people of the city were unhappy with the outcome of these negotiations, things could quickly spin out of control, and a lot of blood might be shed. Eventually, the governor and his allies agreed to the formation of a junta, although with only limited powers, ruling alongside the colonial authorities. This proposed compromise made no mention of popular sovereignty or even autonomy from Spain, let alone independence. Some of the more moderate patriots seemed inclined to take the deal, but it was nowhere near enough for the radicals, who commanded the loyalty of the mob outside the Cabildo. Things were at a dangerous impasse. Outside the building, the crowd began to chant, quote, "The people want to know what is going on," end quote, which has become an enduring slogan in Argentinian politics right up until today. The mood was turning ugly. Members of the crowd stormed some of the outlying government buildings, but stopped short of entering the hall where the Cabildo was being held, for the moment. Finally, it became clear to Governor Cisneros and his allies that they had only two choices: acquiesce to the demands of the patriots, or take their chances with the mob. And so, on May 25, 1810, Governor Cisneros resigned his office. The colonial administration was dissolved, passing its authority to the newly formed Provisional Governing Junta of the Provinces of the Rio de la Plata. The patriots had won. As that name suggests, this new junta claimed authority over the entire colony. But the revolution had been essentially a Buenos Aires affair. The patriot leaders who had been present at the Cabildo were all based in the capital, and the crowd outside the building, whose intervention had been decisive, was composed entirely of citizens of the city. But the viceroyalty covered a huge geographic area. Nobody outside the capital had been consulted about the formation of an entirely new political system that they were all now apparently expected to embrace and obey. Only a week had passed between the announcement of the open Cabildo and the resignation of the governor and declaration of the junta. By the time many people in the colony got the news, the revolution was already over. Many residents of the Rio de la Plata had no more desire to be ruled by Buenos Aires than they did to be ruled by Madrid. And so, as the patriots of Buenos Aires celebrated their victory, the stage was already set for a reaction. But that's a topic for the future. At almost the same time, a very similar situation was playing out in the north. The patriots of New Granada had been stirred to action by the same news that had galvanized their comrades on the Rio de la Plata. Spanish defeats at the hands of the French had weakened the Spanish government, and many believed Napoleon was on the verge of victory in Iberia. The patriots believed they had to act. The colonial administration had never been weaker, and a legitimate government had to be established now. Otherwise, they might risk falling under French domination if the Spanish surrendered to Napoleon. In the city of Caracas, a group of leading patriots invited the senior Spanish government official, Captain General Vicente Amparan, to a meeting at City Hall. Amparan agreed, but had second thoughts when he saw a large crowd already assembled outside the building. Seeing the Captain General, the crowd began to chant, quote, "To City Hall, to City Hall," end quote. It became clear to Amparan that whatever was happening here was much more than an informal meeting with a group of concerned citizens. He began to back away, but one of the patriots grabbed him roughly by the arm, saying, quote, "The people are calling you, sir," end quote. Amparan looked to his guards, but their commander was a Creole with liberal sympathies. He had already ordered them to stand down. The Captain General had no choice but to enter City Hall practically as a prisoner. As you might have guessed, the subject of this coerced meeting was the formation of a junta. The Captain General was in a difficult position, but he remained obstinate. His arrogant attitude was too much for one of the leading patriots, a Catholic priest named Cortez, who launched into a tirade against the Captain General, asking him if he was really so clueless as to be unaware how much the people hated him. Amparan told Father Cortez he was wrong. The people loved him. They were loyal to Spain and supported the administration. To demonstrate his point, he went out to the balcony and called out to the crowd, asking if they approved of him and of Spanish rule. The crowd thundered back, quote, "No, no, no," end quote, then began to chant, quote, "We don't want it, we don't want it," end quote. It seems Amparan really was that clueless. He was apparently completely shocked by this reaction. After a moment of surprised silence, he shouted back, quote, "Then I do not want it either," end quote. And that was that. Less than 48 hours later, the now former Captain General Vicente Eperon left the colony forever. The city was now in the hands of a new government, calling itself the Supreme Junta of Caracas, dedicated to preserving the rights of King Ferdinand VII. Despite that long-winded name, a little over a year later, they would declare full independence from Spain. The patriots in the colonial capital of Bogotá followed suit a few months later. For quite some time, they had been petitioning the governor, a former military officer named Antonio José Amar y Borbón, about forming a junta. The governor refused to budge. And not only that, he had treated their proposals with contempt, deliberately snubbing the patriot petitioners. Governor Amar's position was weakened by the news from Spain, just like every other Spanish colonial official. But he had a deeply ingrained prejudice against the Creoles, and it was obvious he would never give an inch unless his hand was forced. And so, the patriots decided to force his hand. To do so, they would incite a riot in the city. To do that, they would execute a somewhat complicated plan, revolving around a vase. A reception was being planned in the city for a group of visiting dignitaries. The visitors and the people hosting the party were all Creoles. On the morning of July 20th, 1810, a group of Creole patriots approached a local businessman named Gonzalo Llorente, asking to borrow a vase so they could decorate the hall for the reception. Llorente was a Peninsulare, and was well known for his bigoted attitudes towards Creoles. They knew he would never agree to allow, what was, from his perspective, a bunch of uppity Americanos to borrow a valuable possession to help celebrate another pack of uppity Americanos. Sure enough, Llorente was outraged at the very suggestion. Not only did he say no, he began angrily insulting the Creoles. This was exactly what they had been hoping for. They escalated the argument, and soon there was a fist fight on the threshold of Llorente's store. Seeing two grown men beating the hell out of each other in broad daylight, a crowd began to gather, and naturally began asking each other what was going on. The patriot agitators who had helped orchestrate this incident were happy to inform them, and went into great detail about all the insulting things Llorente had said about Americanos. Soon, the curious onlookers were looking more and more like an angry mob, and they were not only angry at Señor Llorente. Just as the patriots had hoped, this one bigoted merchant had become a symbol for everything the people of the city hated about the Peninsulares. Just as the patriots had hoped, events began to spiral out of control. The local authorities were all either unwilling or unable to restore order. The patriots had seized the initiative. That afternoon, they formed a junta. Up until today, July 20th is celebrated as Colombian Independence Day. Perhaps Llorente should have just given them that vase. The new junta tried to make peace with Governor Amar to secure an orderly transition, but he was unwilling to play ball. Within a few days, he was under arrest. On July 26th, the junta passed the Act of Independence, formally cutting the colony's ties with Spain. As I said last episode, we don't really have time to go into these events in great detail. But these stories of the fallout of the abdications of Bayonne in Spanish America are too dramatic and too important to subsequent world history to ignore. What I've presented here are basically just snapshots and anecdotes, but hopefully they've given you at least some vague sense of how these countries started down the road to independence. As you may have guessed from the narrative, that road would be long and difficult. In this episode, we've seen the patriots ascendant in many parts of Spanish America, but such drastic change always provokes a reaction. The royalists were far from beaten, and the new patriot juntas springing up all over the continent would make a lot of enemies. Before we go, it's worth reflecting on the implications of these events for our main story in Europe. Obviously, Napoleon's ambitions of building a new overseas colonial empire in Spanish America would not be realized. Essentially, nobody on the continent wanted French rule. Joseph Bonaparte's government may have claimed sovereignty over these regions, but with no significant foothold in mainland America and no reliable way to project power across the Atlantic, these claims were nothing but hot air. Both the Patriots and the Royalists proclaimed their loyalty to King Ferdinand, at least at this stage. But their ongoing violent struggle meant the colonies would be of little help to Spain. As the Spanish worked desperately to organize resistance to Bonaparte, they would have to do so without the money and resources of the Spanish Main, which only a few years ago had represented more than half of all government revenues. There would be a few exceptions. Some dedicated royalist officials did send what help they could across the Atlantic, but they had to worry about staving off the Patriots in their own backyards, and the colonies would soon be devastated by war. These small and irregular shipments never came close to matching pre-war revenues. This made the Spanish all the more dependent on other sources of money, such as their British allies. Speaking of the British, as we saw last episode, they had their own ambitions for Spanish America, mostly gaining access to its markets and resources. As we saw last episode, the British had failed in their attempts to achieve this by conquest. However, the political developments we've discussed in this episode would give them almost everything they wanted at essentially no cost. As I've alluded to several times in this episode, the Spanish American Patriots were generally liberals. Most liberals favored commerce and free trade. The old colonial-era restrictions on trade to Spanish America had been designed to enrich Spanish merchants, and had generally done so at the expense of the local people. The Patriots hated the old regulated trade system, for both ideological and practical reasons. No surprise, wherever they gained power, one of the first items on the agenda was usually abolishing commercial regulations and opening up the regions they controlled to free trade. With Britain's dominance over international commerce, free trade usually meant British trade, sometimes with U.S. merchants playing a supporting role. With Spain in chaos, even royalist-controlled areas were forced to open their doors to British commerce. The colonies were not economically self-sufficient. In fact, the Spanish had worked quite deliberately to ensure they were not, so they could remain a profit center for those Spanish middlemen who sold them European goods. Now, with that old system of exclusive trade with Spain destroyed by Napoleon's invasion, only the British were in a position to pick up the slack, and they did so with great enthusiasm. Despite its flaws, the continental system had been damaging to the British economy, just as Napoleon had hoped. By this point in the story, British merchants were desperate for new markets, to compensate for the loss of trade with French-occupied Europe. Napoleon had first begun meddling in Iberia to close a hole in the continental system, but that meddling had set off a chain of events that would throw those desperate British merchants a lifeline. Nearly 20 million new customers, and a whole continent full of fallow land and untapped resources, ripe for investment. According to modern scholarship, these new opportunities in Spanish America more than compensated British businessmen for the loss of lucrative European markets. Despite the failure of their invasions of the Rio de la Plata, Spanish America would become an important cog in Britain's commercial machine. Profits from these new markets would help fuel the war effort, and keep the home front quiet as they continued their struggle against France. By now, it was pretty obvious that Napoleon's invasion of Spain had been a mistake, but the scale of that mistake was actually much greater than anyone at the time could have contemplated. That's all for now. Next episode, we'll return to Europe and the main narrative. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, thank you again for your support. I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. Don't forget to get in your questions in the comment section under the last bonus episode on Patreon. As for the rest of you, I hope you'll consider signing up. It is just $2 a month, and it helps me tremendously. And, as always, thanks for listening.